Brothers. From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Nandi Show, connecting your neighborhood with the world. It's Tech Tuesday. It was a game-changing technology, and they said it would destroy life as we know it. On March 22, 1876, the New York Times wrote about a new device called the telephone, detailing the promises of this machine that could capture the voice of one person and transfer it over wires to someone miles away. But it also warned of a sinister outcome. Church pews and music halls left empty. People would stop coming since they'd be able to hear the sermon or the concert performance from the comfort of their homes. Today, those claims seem ridiculous, but we still see technology as a mixed blessing, especially in the era of smartphones, wireless internet, and Twitter. Sure, Google has become a powerful tool for research and learning, but it's making us stupid, or at least intellectually lazy. Sure, Twitter allows us to connect with people in new ways, but it's breeding a new generation of online narcissists who update everything. Nick Bilton says those gloom and doom predictions missed the mark. Nick Bilton is lead writer and technology reporter for the New York Times Bits blog and author of the book I Live in the Future and Here's How It Works. He joins us from studios in New York. Nick Bilton, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
We've always had a love-hate relationship with technology, and when the first caveman discovered fire, somebody probably complained that it would keep kids awake at night and prevent them from learning to hunt. You call this technochondria. What's that?
Well, it's essentially the idea that, you know, we're afraid of every technology that comes into society, and we've done this for centuries and hundreds of years, and you're probably right. You know, there was probably, you know, discussions in the caves when they invented fire about this being a bad technology and so on. But you know, more relevant to today, you know, we saw this happen with the printing press. We've seen it happen with the telephone, the phonograph, the television. We've seen it happen with trains. It happens with every new technology that displaces society, and then we get used to it, and it settles down, and we start to look at the next thing and worry about that.
Could you read for us the section in your book where it talks about how the telephone was first greeted?
Yeah, so it says, this was the article in the New York Times on that morning that the telephone was first greeted, and it says the rural visitor who spends a Sunday in town and reads a printed notice in the office can be had at 11 o'clock instead in the telephone room listening to the telephone. And then he says, you know, thus the telephone, by bringing music and ministers into every home, will empty the concert halls and churches. It is an unpleasant task to point out and possibly the possible sinister purpose of this device.
Well, apparently it did not happen. There are those who say the new wired world is making us stupid. There are those who fall into a more optimistic camp, who think that new technology is not something to fear, but something to dive into. You come from the optimist camp. Why?
Well, I come from the optimist camp, but I'm not an internet utopian. I definitely recognize some of the fears that we should be, you know, be aware of. But the reason that the title "I Live in the Future and Here's How It Works" is I essentially grew up on with technology as a major part of my life. I had my first computer when I was 4 years old and first video game system at the same time, and I've always been involved in technology. And I you know, my brain still works in a pretty normal way. And I wanted to, when I started writing the book, I wanted to go out and see, well, you know, people are saying that by using Google and by using these devices and technologies that we're ruining our brains. And I didn't quite buy that. So I went out and I spoke to neuroscientists and researchers and experts in evolution. And it turns out that our brains just adapt. They don't necessarily it's not evolution that's taking place right now, but it's adaption. And the thing that I found that was really fascinating was that the neuroscientists said that our brains were never even designed to read, right? That we use an area of our brain in the frontal lobe that actually that we look at for symbols and objects, and we use that to read. And so if we're going to talk about technology being bad for us, we should talk about reading being bad for us.
We'd like you to join this conversation at 800-433-8850. Are you a digital native who thinks new technology works to simply adapt our brains, or are you one of those who thinks that this is doing something bad to our brains, that for some reason or the other we are losing skills that we need? 800-433-8850, or you can go to our website, kojoshow.org, send us a tweet at kojoshow or an email to kojo@wamu.org. We're talking with Nick Bilton. He is lead writer and technology reporter for the New York Times Bits blog and author of the book I Live in the Future and Here's How It Works. It's one thing to say that technology is changing everything, that we're in the midst of a user-centric media environment, but those phrases don't always mean very much. Early in this book, you have a simple but useful illustration of what that means. You use the example of a tourist traveling to a new city and trying to figure out where they are on a map. Could you compare how that would be done, old template, new template?
Yeah, so in the past, maps are something that we've transitioned through for the most part already. In the past, let's just say I went to New York City, I would ask for a map of New York City. But now I pull out my cell phone and I click this little button on my phone that says locate me, and a little blue dot appears right in the center of my phone. And what that is it puts me in the center of the map. So the location that I'm in, the map is created around that. It's not the other way around. It's not me going into the map. It's me. It's the map coming around me, and we're seeing that change take place throughout everything that we do. I have the intro to the book talks about, I canceled my subscription to the New York Times, and not because I didn't want to consume the New York Times. It was because I wanted a more personalized experience. I didn't want to see the sports section. I didn't want to see certain things that I'd already read online, and I wanted to create that experience in a digital form. And I think that that's something that's transitioning across all of our experiences.
It's my understanding that when you made that revelation to your employer, that it was a bit problematic for you.
Yeah, it was, and this was a couple of years ago. I tell the story about how I was out in California. I was giving a talk at a technology conference, and there was a Wired reporter that interviewed me about some of the work I was doing. I used to work in the New York Times Research and Development Labs, and the goal there was to look 2 to 10 years out, and we played around with flexible displays and hyper-personalized printed newspapers and things like that. And the article, when it came out on Wired.com, talked about how I'd canceled my subscription. And I came back to New York, and it didn't go over so well. Some people within the building were really annoyed that I'd said that publicly. And my response was, maybe instead of people being mad at me for saying that I don't read the print paper, they should be asking me what I do instead, because I'm part of this next generation that's developing these new experiences. And I had friends that worked in the music industry that went through the exact same thing. So they worked in the music industry when MP3s were coming out, and they told their bosses, hey, I'm not buying CDs anymore. I'm downloading music. And their bosses are like, you're crazy. No one will ever want to do that. And now I know people that are going through that same thing in the movie industry, where they're saying, I'm not going to movie theaters anymore. I'm staying at home and I'm streaming these things, and I'm even stealing them on BitTorrent because that's the way I want to experience it. And their bosses are now saying, well, you don't know what you're talking about. And so I really think that we can tell from the next generation what's going to happen next by looking at their actions.
Well, your admission to the New York Times, while it was met with some degree of consternation, is also an indication that the New York Times, one of the older media establishments, is grappling with what new disruptive technologies mean for its bottom line. The Times is also a true innovator in the next order of thinking about how the news will be delivered. As somebody who straddles these two worlds, you have to look at your newspaper and say, well, it's certainly trying.
Oh, without a doubt. And I address that in the book. I say that it was a minority of people that had talked to me about canceling my subscription. And for the most part, the New York Times is by far ahead of everyone else in what they're doing digitally. There's so much innovation in the newsroom, and the fact that they have a research and development labs in the New York Times speaks momentous to that. But I think everyone's going through these transitions. Everyone is going through the changes that are taking place with technology. And it's not just media companies. If you look over the next 5 to 10 years, it's going to be everyone. It's going to be the Gap with the clothes that you wear. It's going to be the coffee shop where you buy your coffee. It's the internet is going to be embedded in absolutely everything. And it's going to have sweeping changes on society that we haven't even envisioned yet.
I love reading the newspaper. I love the smell of it. I love the sound it makes when I fold it. I love reading it over breakfast and invariably getting all kinds of stains on it. And I may not be convinced that my iPad or a computer screen can replicate that experience. What do you think?
Well, I think that's something that you enjoy, and that doesn't mean that that's going to go away. You know, a million people still buy the print New York Times every day, and you know, 47 million newspapers go out the door every day from other organizations. But I think part of it's generational, and I think that, you know, I used to love my New York Times too. I used to love the print of the paper in the morning, and then I replaced that with a social experience and a screen. And one of the things I found when I was researching the book, because the whole debate over screens versus paper always comes up, and it's always a very heated discussion. And I found these research papers around cell phones. And what they're finding is that for the next generation, they are so connected to that cell phone because it connects them to their loved ones, it connects them to the people they care about, it connects them to information, that they have that same exact experience and that feeling for a digital device that is socially connected that a lot of other people do for printed paper because of the way it feels.
I got it.
And so...
Go ahead, please.
No, and there was a research paper I found called The Digital Umbilical Cord, and it was actually... It followed kids in Israel that, you know, they moved out of their parents' house and they were given a cell phone and they felt this connection to this device that was second to none.
I got to tell you, I never thought that I would enjoy reading books digitally, but I love my Kindle. Who knew? Here is Mike in Maryland on the phone. Mike, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, thank you very much for your time. Actually, the digital umbilical cord leads into one of my two questions. I was wondering if you ever found any research that, you know, I think it's wonderful that you can connect to Facebook and I have friends in Thailand that I met and they all stay connected. But I was wondering if there's any research or you have opinion on whether it's possible to have a number of, like, hours to actually see somebody and be connected physically and socially that way, opposed to just online. And then my second question...
I'm not sure I understood the first, so let's take them one at a time. Nick Bilton, I hope you did.
I didn't actually understand the first.
So could you repeat the first question? It seems to be a comparison between spending time with somebody online and seeing them face-to-face?
Exactly. You know, it's possible now to have conversations with people around the world, but you're just in your basement and never actually getting in front of somebody to have a conversation. I was wondering if there's a human need for face-to-face communication that way.
And if there's been any study done showing the difference between the two kinds of communication in terms of what effect they have on what?
Yeah, I mean, definitely.
I guess it's psychological effects.
Oh, okay.
If the human actually needs face-to-face conversation, or is it just simply the feeling of being connected to somebody else?
Nick Bilton?
Yeah, so we do need face-to-face conversation without a doubt, but it's not all or nothing, you know. You know, people still go to concerts, you know, they still go to conferences. You know, people travel hundreds of thousands of miles every year to go to conferences related to their businesses where they could watch it streaming on the web, but it's a different experience, right? It's you don't have that face-to-face interaction. You don't have the serendipity of the people that you meet. You don't have the touch and feel of a human being, and we do need those, but it's not one or the other. I think that we can have different relationships that connect us in ways digitally that work. And you know, people eyesight. You know, I eyesight with my nephew every once in a while. He's 4 years old, lives in California, and it's a conversation that we have, and it's a connection. And there's a lot of research that shows how for the next generation, they don't necessarily differentiate the two as much. They don't want to be, you know, sitting in a basement having conversations with people that way, but they don't say, hey, this is not a way to communicate with people. They do engage with both, but we're always going to need that human interface and that human touch. And I think that's what mobile devices are helping us do. They're helping us get out of the basement and go outside, but still be connected to the web in different ways.
Interestingly enough, Nick, we had the author Hal Nedzwiecki on the show. He's the author of The Peep Diaries. He had an interesting experiment where he invited his 1,000-plus friends on Facebook to come out for a happy hour. Only one showed up, and he was kind of surprised about that.
That's very funny. Yeah, it's understandable. That's you know, we still have these fears and trepidation when it comes to human interaction with people we've met online for certain people. But what I've found is that the the next generation, there is no differentiation as much. And it's happened with me. I've met people online that that I have become extremely close with and extremely friendly with, and you know, never even met them in person. I have a chapter in the book called you know, Meet Sam H, My Really Good Friend. And this guy is he's somebody I met through the game the service Foursquare.
Mm-hmm.
And for the listeners who don't know, Foursquare is a social networking game where you check into restaurants and bars and coffee shops, and you can leave tips, but it becomes a game, right? And the whole concept is to become the mayor of a place, and the mayor is the person that goes there the most. And so I was the mayor of my local coffee shop, and then all of a sudden one day I wasn't, and there was a guy by the name of Sam H who had become the mayor, and I was like, this is crazy. I go here every day. How can Sam H be the mayor of this coffee shop? So I ran home and I Googled him, and it turned out we both teach at NYU. We both live in the same neighborhood, and I sent him an email and I said, hey, what are you doing on my turf? You know, back off. And it was joking, and we developed this friendship, and I never met Sam H. And I still, to this day, we text message once in a while when we find new restaurants. You know, if we see one of us has checked into a coffee shop, we recommend things that we know each other would like. And there's a friendship there that developed with someone that I never spend time with.
Got to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Nick Bilton. Mike, I know you have a second question that you're going to ask. We'll get back to you after we come back from this short break. Nick Bilton is author of the book, I Live in the Future, and Here's How It Works. He is lead writer and technology reporter for the New York Times Bits blog. You can still call us, 800-433-8850, with your comments or questions about the digital life, so to speak. I'm Kojo Namdi.
Support for Tech Tuesday on WAMU 88.5 comes from Google Federal, offering online applications with independently audited security for today's government workforce. Testimonials and a cost analysis calculator for Google Apps are at google.com/federal/apps. And from the German Embassy, celebrating 20 years of German unity and German-U.S. cooperation and facing the challenges of our times. More information at their web publication on politics, culture, and lifestyle on germany.info. And from CDWG, dedicated to providing technology solutions for federal IT customers through a range of brands, contract offerings, and configuration and support services. More at cdwg.com/federal.
Today on Tell Me More, Detroit's public schools have suffered from low attendance and thus low graduation rates for years. Michelle Martin speaks with Detroit Public Schools Emergency Financial Manager Robert Bob about plans to get the city's schools back on track this afternoon at 2 on Tell Me More. Live from the IBMA World Bluegrass Conference, it's six artists, including Bluegrass Bells of Delamay, this afternoon from 3 to 6 on WAMU's Bluegrass Country. That's at 105.5 FM from Reston, Virginia, and on WAMU's HD Channel 2. You can listen online at bluegrasscountry.org. 78 degrees in Northwest Washington. Now let's return to the Kojo Namdi Show.
It's a Tech Tuesday conversation on the so-called disruptive aspects of technology and how it affects our brains and our lives. We're talking with Nick Bilton. He is lead writer and technology reporter for the New York Times Bits blog and author of the book, I Live in the Future, and Here's How It Works. We're taking your calls at 800-433-8850. We left off with Mike in Maryland. Mike, you're on again. Go ahead, please.
Oh, thank you for the follow-up. I have a question for you regarding the authority of research online, with the accessibility of Wikipedia and all sorts of different resources. Sometimes it gets a little difficult to figure out the authority of some of these publications, I guess, for lack of a better word. And I was wondering if you're worried about maybe a false authority or a false authoritative voice that some people may take as may take very seriously, even though there's absolutely no grounded research or logic or reason behind some of this.
You mean the supermarket tabloid of the online environment? Here's Nick Bilton.
Yeah, I talk about this in the book. There's a chapter called Trust Markets, and it's what we trust online, and I kind of look at it in this way as almost like a stock portfolio where you place things in there and you give them different relevance and how far you trust them and how far you don't. And if something, you know, if something betrays your trust, it's out. You know, you don't really get a second chance in these experiences. But what we found is that and a lot of research shows this, is that people don't necessarily trust big organizations anymore. They trust the people within them. You know, there's Pew Research and Forrester Research and a number of other research companies that have found that, you know, we generally trust corporations in the 20% range. We trust newspapers in the 30% range. We trust large organizations even less. But we trust people almost 90%, you know, and people that we don't even know, we trust them 60-70%. And what we've found is that that people, you know, they're using their social networks like Twitter and Facebook, and they're placing people within them and using them as authorities. And as far as mainstream content that goes out there and it becoming, you know, false content like on Wikipedia and things like that, we saw this happen a couple of weeks ago with the – there was a couple of tornadoes that happened in Brooklyn, New York, and in the Bronx. And there was a photo that somebody had put on Twitter, and it was a tornado over the Statue of Liberty. Turns out it was actually a photo from the 1950s. And it was everywhere. It was on the news sites. It was everywhere. But it went away in about two hours or so because people realized the same people that had helped push it up to the top helped push it down to the bottom, saying, "Hey, this isn't real." So those are some of the things we're seeing.
Mike, thank you for your call. We move on to Jim in Alexandria, Virginia. Jim, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I think that the real potential harm for sites like Facebook is going to be felt in the next generation, because I'm on Facebook and I find that my relationships with people who are not on Facebook has really suffered, but at least I have the basis of the relationship with the people on Facebook was based in something real relationships before, you know, the computer age and we had Facebook and all of that, and I'll be very interested to see what happens when the next generation comes along and they have entire relationships that are based electronically. I don't see how your guests can claim that somehow is as legitimate and real and fulfilling as relationships that are based in legitimate human contact.
I'm not saying that they are legitimate. They are better than a relationship in real life. I said earlier that we do need those in-person relationships. Anyone that thinks otherwise is the same person that's saying that the telephone is going to MC concert halls and no one will ever leave their house again. What I'm saying is that there's a balance between the two, and I think that there are relationships that will work online exclusively because of locations and time spans and things like that, and then there are relationships that will develop in person, and there'll be 100 different types of relationships in between there that blur all those lines.
I don't know if this is relevant, Nick Bilton, but this we got from Betty in Silver Spring. Your author mentioned that our brains were not necessarily designed for reading. I heard recently on NPR, probably an interview with this author, possibly, that the ancient Greek philosopher Socrates warned against the dire consequences that the widespread use of writing and reading could have on intelligence. The idea seemed to be that humans would no longer have to remember anything because they could easily refer to something in writing, and this would cause mental laziness. I would love to know if that's really true. That is, if Socrates said it. Was that you who talked about that, Nick?
I have talked about it before, but I've heard it discussed by some other people too. But absolutely, that was a big thing that he discussed.
That's the knock on Google, isn't it?
Yeah, that was that Google is making us stupid. But he, you know, Socrates said, you know, that we shouldn't let kids read and write because that they will forget things and that they'll be laziness. I mean, it's funny because there was when the pencil and the eraser when the eraser was invented, there was newspaper articles around the eraser saying that it would make people lazy because then they can make mistakes easier. You know, it's every technology we worry about, every new iteration in society. But going to the Socrates point, the thing that's fascinating about the way our brains work is people think that we're evolving, you know, online. And that's absolutely not true, because evolution with the human brain takes place over hundreds of thousands of years, right? The alphabet is only 5,000 years old. The printing press is only 500 years old. The internet is 20 years old. And so our brains aren't evolving. Our brains are still working in the same way. They're just adapting to the technologies that are there for us. And if you know, people sometimes say, well, I used to be able to remember anybody's phone number, right? And now I don't think I could because I have a cell phone. If I took your cell phone away and said, hey, that's it, no more remembering people's phone numbers, no more relying on your cell phone for people's phone numbers, you'd be able to remember people's phone numbers again because your brain, that's just the way it works. It's elastic. It conforms to these new changes.
Indeed, I recognize changes in my own brain or differences in the way I process information and my younger colleagues process information. You just mentioned it. I can rattle off the phone numbers of pretty much everyone that I know. My younger colleagues, my children simply can't do that. The human brain evolved over thousands of years, so it's not very likely that any technology, even these new transformative technologies, are going to fundamentally rewire the brain. But the point you seem to be making is that researchers are looking at the brain and trying to measure something that you just mentioned called plasticity of the brain.
Yeah, so this goes back to some of this stuff was actually discovered with jugglers about people that learned how to juggle before and after, and some neuroscientists measured their brain before and after and found that the brain kind of rewired itself and actually reshaped itself a little bit. And what the researchers are now finding, and there hasn't been that much research around the way that the internet is affecting our brains, but Gary Small at UCLA, who runs the neuroscience department out there, he scanned people's brains that were reading a book and people that were reading on the internet using Google, and he found that the brain acts in an extremely different way. It's much more engaged online because it's there's all these cognitive processes that we're going through, and we're holding a mouse and keyboard and so on. But what was fascinating was that these brains that he scanned were people that were 60 years old. These weren't people that had grown up with the web. These are people that had grown into the web. There's a lot of technologies out there, video games included, that show that our brains, that they just rewire themselves and adapt. And if we take the things away, they go back to exactly where they were before.
Back to the telephones. Here's Paul in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Paul, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, yeah. Hi. I think I would make a kind of a drastic statement that I think the virtual world actually undermines the pre-existing real world, the natural world. And I think it's important for a couple reasons. One is, like, we've seen the effect of technologies, modern technology, industrial technologies on the environment. But what people, I think, don't realize is that digital technologies actually increase electrical use, plus the innovation, the constant innovation and turnover in products impacts the increasing production, distribution, consumption, and there's also the disposal problems. A lot of the elements that are used in the chips and stuff. And I think that's just on the basic, the nuts and bolts level. But also I think the digital technologies, like the technosphere, actually prevents us from seeing the effects because it's so increasingly invasive that we live more and more and more in the technosphere, and we actually don't see what's really going on in terms of the impacts it's having in the oceans, in the forests, in the climate, and all these things.
So you're making fundamentally the argument, Paul, that all digital technology is creating a more severe environmental problem than we already have?
Yeah, it's a cumulative.
Okay, allow me to have our guest respond to that. Nick Bilton?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, but it's not just digital devices. I mean, cutting trees down to make paper products does the same thing. These are all of these technologies are bad for society. But what's interesting is I think over the next 20 to 30 years, that's actually going to change because we're reaching a plateau with what we can do with these digital devices, right? We're eventually going to reach a point where they're going to become organic, right? You're starting to see the tiny little glimpses of it where people, are making shapes out of DNA and things like that. And I think that eventually, your little Apple computer is going to be a little Apple cell or something like that. But for the next 20, 30 years, I think we have to be really careful about not just digital devices, but all kind of technology, whether it's reading books or magazines or anything, and the effect that they have on the environment.
Thank you for your call, Paul. On to Allison in Baltimore, Maryland. Allison, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I wanted to make a comment about checking in with your phone or whatever device you're using. I have friends that tell me when they're at a show or at a coffee shop or whatever, and I find myself rolling my eyes at them because it seems kind of self-obsessed or, you know, just like a craving attention for whatever they're doing and needing to update it 24 hours a day. And I guess I just wanted to hear what you thought about that.
You know, I suspect Nick Bilton, and I, of course, I haven't studied this, so I could be really, really wrong, that that is meeting a desire that people always had. They just didn't have the technology to do it before. It seems to be not just that the technology is changing, it's the expectations of consumers. We're no longer content with a one-size-fits-all media. We want media that provides a full user experience. So the notion of staying connected to your friends through your cell phone is a desire that can simply now be satisfied.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I do tend to actually agree that, that, you know, that checking in and updating your Twitter status and Facebook every 10 seconds is not good for us. It's you know, you're not connected, and I think that there's a balance, you know. I mean, but you could take this, you could take that argument and you could apply it to somebody who reads books, right? You could say, hey, this person, they always have a book with them. They bring it out at dinner, they do this, they do that. And you would say, hey, this isn't cool. Like, this is something that they're taking it too far and they're not being social. And I think that we're still figuring out those balances. You know, this is all so new. I mean, you know, smartphones are essentially have only really started to make it into the marketplace over the last few years, and we're still figuring out the balances between all these different things. And you know, I used to, when I first started using Foursquare, for example, I checked in everywhere, and now I don't. I check in to a few places here and there, and I use it on it sporadically, and I use it when I think it's going to be useful and fun.
Thank you for your call, Alice. Much of the internet and breakthroughs for the physical structure or the physical infrastructure of the web came about in part because of military applications. But when it comes to an increasingly content-driven future, you say we should not be looking to the defense industry. We should be looking at the pornography industry. How has the porn industry transformed technology?
Well, one of the first chapters in the book talks about this, and I, you know, when I sat down to start writing and researching, I said to myself, okay, well, let me look online and see who's making money. And I went through all these different industries, and it turned out that only a couple of industries were doing it, and the one that had been doing it for quite a long time was the porn industry. And so I went out to California, and I met with all of these people in these industries, and what I found was that the Playboys and the Penthouses of the world have essentially failed. They've gone out of business. They've lost hundreds of millions of dollars. Their products aren't selling in the way that they used to. And part of the reason for that is because they've tried to push these analog products. So Playboy still tried to push its cable channel and its $50 DVDs and its magazines. And consumers didn't want that, right? They wanted a much more niche, personalized experience. And what took the place of these organizations, these huge porn houses, was these little essentially they're like little blogs versions of the porn world, and they're small studios with, you know, 12, 15 employees, and they make a few million dollars a year, and they're pretty profitable for what they do, and they don't have the infrastructure and the costs that a lot of the old media companies do. And we're seeing that same thing happen in the media world today. And the porn industry's been making money online for two decades, you know, billions of dollars, actually. So it was pretty fascinating to see what they were doing.
I'm really glad to hear you discuss it so dispassionately. I'd be interested in hearing the response of, oh, maybe your wife, when you told her that you were going to be researching the porn industry.
Yeah, it was pretty funny. She at first she was like, "Okay, that's fine," and then when I went out to Los Angeles to interview some people, one of the companies said, "Hey, do you want to meet with I forget the people's names, but some of the big stars in the industry, big porn stars?" And my wife was like, "You don't need to meet with them. There's no reason for that." And so it was pretty funny.
But it's all research, dear. We've got to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Nick Bilton. He is lead writer and technology reporter for the New York Times Bits blog. His book is called I Live in the Future and Here's How It Works. If you haven't called yet, the number is 800-433-8850, or you can go to our website, kojoshow.org, ask a question or make a comment there. It's Tech Tuesday. I'm Kojo Namdi. Coming up at 1, the future of the century-old NAACP, plus Pulitzer Prize-winning author Alice Walker on turning grief into poetry. Today at 1 on the Kojo Namdi Show on WAMU
88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from the German Embassy, celebrating 20 years of German unity and German-U.S. cooperation in facing the challenges of our times. More information at their web publication on politics, culture, and lifestyle on germany.info. And from CDWG, dedicated to providing technology solutions for federal IT customers through a range of brands, contract offerings, and configuration and support services. More at cdwg.com/federal. And from Project Management Institute's Global Congress, October 9th through 12th at the Gaylord National, featuring extreme project managers, a former U.S. president, a Paralympic gold medalist, and the CIO of the United States. More at pmi.org.
This afternoon at 2 on Tell Me More, violinist and music educator Sebastian Ruth is among the 23 new MacArthur Fellows for 2010. He was awarded the prize for providing richly rewarding musical experiences and education for urban youth and their families while forging new roles beyond the concert hall for the 21st century. Michelle Martin speaks with Sebastian Ruth this afternoon at 2 on Tell Me More. Now back to the Kojo Namdi Show.
It's a Tech Tuesday conversation on technology and how it affects how we live our lives. We're talking with Nick Bilton. He is lead writer and technology reporter for the New York Times Bits blog. His book is called I Live in the Future and Here's How It Works. We got an email from Rebecca, Nick, that says, many years ago, I developed the habit of reading the entire newspaper. I have broadened my knowledge of many areas by reading articles on topics that initially did not interest me. If I only read about things that I knew I was interested in, I would miss out on that education. I admit that I do, however, skip over stories about Paris Hilton and the Salahis. But some of the gloom and doom predictions, Nick, about the web are probably misguided, but user-centered technology does make it easier to find stories that amplify one's own views. Some people fear that our politics are becoming more polarized because conservatives only read conservative blogs and liberals only read liberal blogs, and we never hear or see anything that challenges our worldview. But you tend to disagree.
I absolutely disagree, and the research disagrees too. I mean, think about 20 years ago or 10 years ago, right? If you were conservative, you watched Fox News and you bought the Wall Street Journal or something like that. You didn't ever pick up the New York Times. You never saw an article from the New York Times. You never saw anything from any liberal magazines. You only saw the things that you wanted to see. And online, what's happened is because of the way that we all link, you know, if a conservative organization writes about a liberal blog post, they're going to link to that blog post and they're going to talk about it, right? If and on your social network, you're going to be friends with people. Sure, you're really going to primarily follow the people that that share information that's relevant to you. But you're also going to be friends with your coworkers and your family members and even your neighbor. And they have different political views or different interests than you do. And because of that, what we're seeing is that you're starting to see things that you never would have actually come across before. And there was a fascinating research study that was done, and I referenced it in the book, where you know, it talks about this idea of homophily, which is the concept of birds of a feather flock together. And the actual research shows that people that, you know, are conservative actually end up seeing more liberal content than they ever have in the history of any kind of media before, because of the way the web works and because of the serendipity we find on there.
In your book, you write about something called anchor communities, basically a network we build of trusted sources across our professional and personal lives. They sort of act as filters?
Yeah, so one of the things I found in the book was I found the research of Benedict Anderson, and he's an amazing anthropologist who wrote this book in the 1980s called Imagined Communities. And the concept was that, you know, if I live in New York City, I'll never meet all the people that live in the city, you know, there's 12 million or so people, but I feel a connection to them, right? And so essentially we're all a part of an imagined community. If I read the print New York Times on a Sunday morning, the same thing. I'll never know the million or 2 million people that are reading that print New York Times. But if I run into someone and we actually start that conversation, we're part of the same community together. And what's happened with the web is everything is now part of an imagined community. Everything is connected to everything else. And so I think what we've started to do with these social networks is develop what I call anchoring communities. So we create these silos where we put all the people in that we trust and that we want to interact with and that we want to see their the things that they're linking to and sharing and talking about. And we're essentially creating these anchors that, you know, in the abyss that is the internet that will never stop growing.
Here is Betsy in Bethesda, Maryland. Betsy, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you for taking my call. I love your show.
Thank you.
And I'll take my comments offline. I come from a long line of classroom teachers, several generations, yet I was the only one to champion the technology boom as an alternative method of learning, because I have a child who was born in 1985 with severe ADHD, ODD, learning disabilities, clinical depression. And what I found in raising him was that video games kept his attention and taught him how to map, taught him how to go from one thing to the next thing to the next thing in an orderly fashion. Sitting in front of a movie with him, I could actually have conversations that were impossible otherwise because he was non-compliant with medications. He dropped out of school at 13, ran away from home, lived 3,000 miles away, but with a cell phone and eventually text messaging and email, we have still remained close. We have contact all the time. He is my best friend. And he's now, without a high school education or a college education, working in a record production company because sitting behind a desk wasn't the kind of learning he did. He learned it all using technology in his telephone. And he has become a shining star in this industry. And I'm proud of him, and I'm proud of myself for not resisting the alternatives that were going to give him a chance to thrive as a successful adult. So that's my comment. Thank you.
Betsy, before you go, you should know that at the beginning of this conversation, Nick Bilton revealed that he got his first computer and his first video game when he was 4 years old. So you're talking to a really empathetic listener here, is she not, Nick?
Actually, a sympathetic listener, because I definitely have trouble concentrating and always have, and I've found that I'm the best when I'm doing multiple things at once. And the video game thing, I mean, I can guarantee there's going to be a whoever's listening to this is going to roll their eyes and shake their head when I say this, but there's so much research around video games that show the positives of it. It's mind-boggling. I mean, there's research that shows that the kids that play first-person shooter video games have better hand-eye coordination, better visual acuity, better working memory. They're better at taking tests.
But how about surgeons?
And surgeons too. I talk about this in the book. There's, you know, laparoscopic surgeons. This is you know, factual research papers that show that laparoscopic surgeons that play video games, you know, are almost 60% faster and 60% more accurate than those that don't. Which is a really, really important thing when you're doing surgery. You don't want to be left open on the operating table taking your time. And you know, there's a long list of these things. And the stuff around video games. And one of the things I argue as far as education is, you know, if we all were in a gym class together, right, we all wouldn't be able to run the mile at the same speed. Some people would do it at 4 minutes. Some people would do it at 10 minutes. But when we transfer to these other classroom experiences, we're expected to read books at the same exact speed and to comprehend the words within those books at the same time. So what if a history class, instead of everyone reading a book, maybe there could be a video game that some kids could play around World War II? And they could learn and engage in a way that's different around some of the history experiences that we're kind of, you know, conditioned to believe that we can only consume with books. And, you know, if you look at the video game research around this, you can see that the science actually shows that this could happen.
Betsy, thank you very much for your call.
Thank you.
On to Allison in Washington, D.C. Allison, your turn. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Kojo, Nick. After listening, I have to say I was almost going to hang up because I'm feeling like such a Luddite. But and everything has its place. But I think that we're missing a really big part of communication, and that's the social skill or the body language or intonation. You know, I Facebook with people, I text with people, and I always say texting is the best way not to talk to someone, because I think we are missing this big part of what communication really is, because it isn't the words. And I would just like to hear what Nick has to say.
Nick.
I mean, I absolutely agree. You know, it's really, really important for people to have these social interactions, these in-person social interactions. And you see this, though. I mean, you see kids that are sitting on the subway or in the park, and they have their iPods and they have their cell phones and their iPads and whatever else, but but they are also they're engaging with each other and they're sharing things. And you know, I had this happen with me. I was out for dinner a few weeks ago with a group of tech bloggers, and we pulled out our cell phones and we were showing each other videos we'd seen during the week and fun things that we'd seen online. And it actually enhanced the conversation, because when we were referencing things, we could actually show them to each other. But I don't think that you can't expect to replace your in-person conversations with digital ones. In certain instances, like I said earlier, when locations and boundaries are there, yes, it makes sense. But I think that the in-person, that's always going to be there. It's never going to go away. It's that same line with the telephone and the phonograph that we'll never leave our house again. We always will. And just another note on that, you know,
sure.
What's fascinating with the book, in the 1450s when the printing press happened, that wasn't the big change in society, because books then were 50 to 100 pounds, right? You went to the library and you read it on a lectern and you didn't carry that thing to the park with you. But in the 1500s, what happened was somebody invented the mobile book. And it was this thing that you could roll up and stick in your pocket, and that was when the huge changes happened in society. And I think the same thing's happening with computers and mobile phones. We don't want to be tied behind a computer, you know, sitting at a desk talking to people. We want to be out and we want to be with each other and communicating, but we kind of want those enhanced experiences too.
Let's talk about multitasking, and thank you for your call, Allison. It's undeniable that our brains are asked to do more these days than they were 20 or even 5 years ago. We check email, we tweet, we log on to Facebook, we surf the web, and we also need to squeeze in some work every once in a while. This is all generated. A big question: can you do all of these things at the same time, or are we basically doing more things poorly? You write about something called the cocktail party effect. What's that?
Well, so the research around multitasking, you know, we've been led to believe that our brains are not designed to multitask, and it's actually not as black and white as that. And, you know, this goes back to this research around what is called the cocktail party effect, and this was a scientist by the name of Colin Cherry, and it was in the 1950s. And he wanted to understand they were having trouble with flight control, and they were having trouble with the flight control in the towers, where they were trying to figure out which airplane was speaking over the loudspeaker, right? And so what they did was they did all this research around how our brains can navigate multiple inputs of conversation, and how we can we multitask between them. And the cocktail party part comes from this idea that if you're at a cocktail party and there's, you know, 100 people there and they're all having conversations and you're in the middle of a conversation, if I walk in and I yell from across the room your name, you're going to turn your head, right? So your brain is processing all this information simultaneously, but it's filtering the things out that aren't relevant. So now when it comes to multitasking, the same thing's happening, right? So we'll never be able to get to a point where we can drive a car and text message at the same time, because that's dangerous. But there's nothing to say that while I'm watching a sports game, I can't read tweets about it too, or I can't tweet about it, or I can't talk to friends on Facebook or even look up statistics online, because what's happening is it's less of a cognitive load for us to switch between tasks that are similar than for us to switch between tasks that are different. And I think that's the really important thing to think about when we talk about multitasking.
But I've been seeing this term disruptive technology all over the place. What do we mean exactly when we describe something as disruptive?
Something that changes. I mean, it has vast changes on society, you know, and the internet is I mean, as much as it's changed society so far, it's going to do it much worse. I mean, worse is, I shouldn't have used that word, but I mean, it's going to be much broader with how it changes. I mean, it's literally, you know, think about, imagine a world before electricity, right? When electricity came along, we didn't imagine that it was going to be in every single thing that we touch. We probably imagined, hey, you know, I'm going to be able to turn on a light in my living room. And electricity is everywhere. It's in our clothes, in the way that our clothes are made. It's in our cars. It's in our homes. It's just everywhere. And the same thing is going to happen to the internet. And it's, you know, right now it's something that we consume media through and that we share information and things. But it will eventually be embedded in everything that we do. And I think that that's going to be the major disruption in society.
On to Todd in Bethesda, Maryland. Todd, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo and Nick. I'm enjoying the show immensely, and we kind of moved past what I was going to talk about or respond to, I guess, from earlier in the show. But I'm an older guy. I'm a Gen Xer who jumped into tech, and now I've raised three boys in the middle of it. But my wife and I both use Second Life, and that's a social media connection point that's not often mentioned in these conversations. And it's completely avatar-based. And one of the things I've noticed about it is that it really does foster some very deep relationships. I've got friends around the country. I've got friends overseas in Croatia and Europe, different places. And through that avatar-based system, I think at times we actually do experience some of the physiological endorphins. Our avatars can high-five, handshake, hug. And, you know, I found that to be really meaningful. And, you know, I was just thinking about that in terms of taking away from real-life relationships. I think it maybe augments them.
What do you think, Nick Bilton?
I mean, I agree. I think that, you know, this worry that one is going to replace the other, it's not that. It's, you know, it's not that we're going to stop leaving our home. It's an addition. It's an augmentation. It's you know, if I – because you know, people worry that we can't – you know, we can't have meaningful relationships with digital experiences. Should I not eyesight with my nephew? Should I not text message my sister or my father? I mean, these aren't replications. They're additions, and they're different strings that tie us together in different ways. And I don't think that one is worse than the other. And for people that, you know, that scoff and roll their eyes at someone who uses Second Life, they don't have to use it. You know, it's to each his own. It's how we decide to use these technologies, and as long as we do it in a balanced way, I think it's completely fine.
This book is available on iPads and other e-readers, but right now I'm holding the paper form in my hands. It's about as old media as it gets, but you've tried to figure out a way of layering the content with the web using barcodes?
Yeah, so there's a feature in the book. I didn't want to just write a book because I think that you know, the ability now is there to make them interactive and you know, to make paper interactive. So there's these little square codes in there. They're called QR codes, and you can download a free application from nickbilton.com, or you can just go online and search for a QR code reader for your phone. And what happens is when you're reading the book, each chapter there's one of these codes, and you can scan it with the application, and then it will take you off to a mobile website where you can see the links that I talk about and click on them. You can watch videos that we've created or videos that I reference in the book. But most importantly, you can comment on the chapters. And people are actually going in there and having a conversation around each chapter, and I think that that's really important. If you can have a conversation around a blog post, you should be able to have a conversation around a book too.
Nick Bilton is lead writer and technology reporter for the New York Times Bits blog and author of the book I Live in the Future, and Here's How It Works: Why Your World, Work, and Brain Are Being Creatively Disruptive. Nick Bilton, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Namdi. Coming up tomorrow on the Kojo Namdi Show, a few massive farms now dominate the pork industry, how consolidation affects your pocketbook and your health, plus how after-school theater, art, and history programs can help fill the void in at-risk communities. The Kojo Namdi Show, noon till 2 tomorrow on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from Noblis, a nonprofit organization bringing scientific thought, management, and engineering.